Last week I talked about technology, these electronic screens and social media in relation, as part of our understanding of them as relationships that we have with other people. They evoke our need for social connection, this human trait that we have. It doesn't have anything to do with any one of us, it's just what we are. So from my perspective, I was suggesting that we would do well if we connected then to Buddha's understanding of relationships and what would be a good relationship. That being someone who supports our practice, keeps us on the path, basically someone who, wise beings, whoever you hold as wise beings, would not disapprove of. And then I added that these technologies also connect us to a lot of stimulus and energy, that they are, they generate and transfer energy with us. And so, like the hindrances, we should watch our this energetic flow of wanting, 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 and not wanting, not wanting, not wanting. And just when we use these screens and technologies, when we're stuck in dullness or excessive energy, all of that, the way we do the hindrances, that we would do well to practice with care around these devices the same way that we practice with the hindrances in relation to our practice. So tonight, I thought I would look at these electronics, these screens, and this idea of social media in relation to the precepts. Just a little deeper, a little like a different way of looking at it. And I thought we could look at it like this over the course of the next 2 weeks, because the implication here is much deeper, I think, than I originally thought. So let me start with a little quote about what the Buddha said about the precepts. He said that whoever destroys living beings, speaks false words, who in the world takes what is not given to, and I'm going to change the pronouns here, to them, or goes to with another's partner, or takes distilled fermented drinks, whatever person indulges thus, extirpates. I had to look that word up because I do not use that word, which means destroys, wipes out, pulls up by the roots. So whoever indulges in this way, they extirpate the roots of themselves, even here in this very world. What I think he's saying is that when we come into this human world, we come into this human world with a, I'd say, fragile mind. This is what I'm beginning to grasp a little here. We come into this world with this fragile mind. And in that mind, we are, if we don't take care with that fragile mind, then we subject it to a lot of possible harm and injury. That's what I think the Buddha is saying. When I think he says you extirpate the roots of themselves, I think what he's saying is you are pulling up the very root that keeps you solid in the human realm. And instead, by violating the precepts or not going through the world with the precepts, we are subjecting this otherwise fragile mind to destruction. The precepts are referred to sometimes as the Dhamma of the human beings. Dhamma, the Dhammas for the human beings. It's a Manasa Dhamma in Pali. Manasa Dhamma. And what I think that means is that it puts the human in humanity. Right? So there's a humanness about how we live as beings. And it's that humanness that I want to really talk about. Because without the human in humanity, we are subjected to the three characteristics, which means that our mind is subjected to an irrational, kind of destructive life, existence. It's subjected to this notion of impermanence, dissatisfaction, and the non-personal nature of that. In 1997, I read this article I didn't read it in 1997. I read this article that Thanissaro Bhikkhu wrote in 1997. He called it the healing power of the precepts. And in this article, he wrote that he noted that the Western meditators tend to be afflicted with a certain grimness and a lack of self-esteem. He's talking about practitioners that he came in contact with. There's a grimness about us, lack of self-esteem. And he surmised that our culture may be at the root of our lack of resilience and persistence, which is what is needed for concentration. I totally agree with that. I've seen it. I think I told you guys, you go on retreats, especially if you go on a long retreat that's divided in half. The only people happy are the people leaving and the people coming. But the people who are staying over, they got a grimness about them. Like, I wish I could leave, but I'm not. I decided to stay 2 months, and now I got to stay. If you go to a retreat center in the middle of a retreat, people walk around with a grimness about them. Like the practice itself is so arduous and painful, you want to ask them, why are you doing this? Why are you subjecting yourself to such misery? Okay, one more thing. So what I took from that article is that the natural mind, when it's subjected to the nature of human life, just regular life, without something else, just like bearing it out in the regular world, our psyche gets hurt a lot by what Thanissaro Bhikkhu, who's this, he's like up there with Bhikkhu Bodhi in terms of being scholars for the Pali Canon, translated a lot of the Pali Canon. So what he pointed to was that when the regular mind is subjected to this natural three characteristics, it gets wounded in two areas, by regret and denial. This is what I think is what happens. When you go on retreat, regret and denial seems to show up, follow you around, like thing one and thing two, pestering you. You're trying to keep it under control because you know you're not supposed to be messing up the house. And thing one and thing two are like running, ranchecking the whole house. You should have never let the cat in the house in there, cat in the hat in the house in the first place. But now you're really getting in trouble. It's really getting ugly. And that's what I think regret and denial does. This is what he said about this. He said that regret is like a festering, like an old open festering wound. And denial is like a hardened scar tissue around the injury. He says that when the mind is wounded in these ways, it can't settle down comfortably in the present, for it finds itself resting on raw, exposed flesh or calcified knots. Even when it's forced to stay, the mind is forced to stay in the present. It's there only in a tense, contorted, and partial way. And so the insights it gains tend to be contorted and partial as well. Only if the mind is free of wounds and scars can it be expected to settle down comfortably and freely in the present. So rest comfortably and freely in the present, and to give rise to an undistorted discernment. That's what it is. This is partly why we have so many difficulties. And he said that the five precepts were designed to heal these two wounds of regret and denial. This really becomes important. You might be saying, like, what does this have to do with the, what does this have to do with technology, electronics, and social media? But I think that this has a lot to do with these screens that we are dealing with. And I probably would have given a completely different talk based on what I was thinking over the last couple of weeks. But I had an intervening cause. Someone asked me to look at a movie called The Social Dilemma. Have you seen that movie? Oh my God, scared the living daylights out of me. All right, so for those of you that have not seen it, it's on it's on Netflix, and it is part one of your homework. Part one. This, it's called The Social Dilemma. It talks about these screens and what it's doing. And it's scary because, first of all, it's a documentary about listening to all these previous people who were part of the whole tech world when it first got created and what was being created and where it is now. And so they're evaluating what has happened with it. It was written, I think it first got released sometime in... when did I check that out? On January 26, 2020 is when it got released. And at the Sundance Film Festival last year, about a year ago, it got released. I'm going to tell you one quote right now. In this film, one of the speaker said, so where's the existential threat that comes with this social media, these electronics, these cell phones and gadgets that we have? And he says, it's not about technology that there's an existential threat. There's no existential threat with our gadgets. There's no threat there. It's just a gadget. He said, but the technology, the technology's ability to bring out the worst in society and the worst in society is the existential threat. Sorry, I can't say that word. That what he's basically saying is the devices themselves don't have a threat, but what they can bring out in us is where the threat lies. And that if we don't pay attention to that, we can be placed into positions and be caught up in thinking and views that create threat for other people. What struck me was, I think that's what happened to us in January. I think there's a whole problem right there. We got all these different views that are going on that spent a year. This movie came out before the year and the months of denying the election, and then ultimately we have all this problem that comes from it. I don't even care whether you believe the election was rigged or not. That's not even my point. The point that I'm making is because of that belief, so much damage happened, rightly or wrongly. This is what I think he's pointing to. So if I think back to basically what Ta-Nehisi Coates was pointing to, is he was saying that if you just do meditation without the precepts and its ethical sila component connected to it, there's a grim kind of lackluster way that we go through life. But if you want to move through the world with the level of awareness and joy that the Buddha's disciples or his students actually move through the world with, then you need the ethical conduct around the precepts. So if we're going to point this towards meditation, you need the precepts around your meditation. If you're going to point this towards going on retreats, then you need the ethical obligations around going on retreats. If you're going to do it with indulging in sense desires, you know, last month when we were talking about wealth, and I realized that the Buddha said for householders, our happiness comes from sense desires. So technology is nothing but sense desire. So our happiness is tied up in these gadgets through the sense doors. We need some precepts around it, or we will subject ourselves to wounds of regret and scar tissue of denial. And that scar tissue and those wounds of regret are going to stay with us and keep us unsettled in our ability to practice. So just a little bit about these precepts before we go too far here. The Buddha called them the five faultless gifts. And the reason why he said they were faultless is because he said they were original, they were longstanding, traditional, ancient, unadulterated, and unadulterated from the beginning, that they're not open to suspicion, will never be open to suspicion, and are unfaltered by knowledgeable contemplatives and Brahmin. This is what he called them. He basically, what I gather from this is he's saying that these five precepts are of ancient understandings that even our ancestors were to live by, they would be faultless, blameless lives, that we, some 2,600 years later, can live by the exact same five trainings, and we also can live a blameless life. And it doesn't matter whether they had screens back then or not. That somehow, if we wrap our usage of technology in the five precepts, that we too can live a blameless life and steady our minds regardless of the technology we're using. Regardless of whether or not we are, we use screens or not. So just a quick reminder here what those five precepts are. They are abstaining from taking life, abstaining from taking what's not given, abandoning illicit, illegal sex, abstaining from lying, and abandoning intoxicants. Abstaining, he said, from taking intoxicants. I think that's for his monastics. So, when we do our, this is where I'd like to talk about the screens in relation to the precepts. When we do our non-residentials, we have a modified way of looking at the precepts. And it's more of, I mean, to be honest, if I'm to be honest, to read this, basically this unadulterated from the beginning, I'm beginning to think we maybe shouldn't have a modified version. We should just stick with what was originally written and leave it at that. But there's a lot of modified versions out there. So I'm going to talk from this modified version and see how to connect it that way. But before I do that, I want to share one more quote from this movie. So, you know, last week I was, or the first talk, I was saying that I just didn't think that somehow this electronics felt different to me because the Buddha didn't have electronics during the time of the Buddha walking around. And I thought, well, you know, like the electronics, he didn't really have that. So this isn't really the same. It's a little different. And I can't remember who said it. Somebody, I think it was Lauren, said, you know, a horse at one point was technology. Fire was technology. I can see that. So I thought, oh, okay, it doesn't really matter. It's all technology of some sort. But in this movie, this is what I think I was thinking of when I was trying, I couldn't articulate it, but one of the speakers in the movie articulated it just fine for me. He says, we weren't saying that bicycles were ruining people, were pulling people away from their kids, meaning that they're riding their bikes way too much and not paying attention to their kids. Basically, we didn't say that bicycles, when they came out as technology, was destroying democracy. That's what he's saying is different about what these screens are doing. That the damage that our electronics are doing, or these artificial intelligence that's connected to these electronics, that's where the problem is. So the way he distinguished it, he said, I didn't get the name of the person that had these quotes, but this is the way one of the speakers distinguished it, said that if you think of a cell phone, this gadget that we use, social media and all of this, as a tool, then if something's a tool, it genuinely is just sitting there waiting patiently for you to use it, right? Your hammer doesn't do anything to you. It waits. It sits there and waits until I need a hammer. Then you go to your hammer, you get your hammer, and you hammer. Do whatever hammering you do. You don't need the precepts in order to be related to this hammer. You may need the precepts in order to be related to your body, your basic body, if you have aversion and you're going to use that hammer to hit somebody. But mostly, that's not the level we're at. Mostly, the hammer is just going to sit there as a tool, and we're going to use it whenever. You don't need the precepts to be wrapped around that hammer. That's what I think he's pointing to about bicycles. They just sit there and wait for us to go ride a bike, and you don't need the precepts to wrap around it in order for you to use it. He says, but these gadgets that we are using as a tool, they are not tools. They are demanding something from us. They are seducing us. They want something from us. So somehow, he said, we've moved away from a knowledge-based technology to an addiction-based technology. And that computers are basically controlling us more than we're controlling them. Now, this is what he's pointing to. So if something is wanting something from you, is seducing you, enticing you, now we're going to have to put a little framework around it so that we don't create harm in the world. That's why we need the precepts around technology. That's why we need to practice with technology as a part of our overall awakening, because if it's just some random gadget, we don't need it. It's a tool. It's just laying there. But since these technologies are designed to pull you in and send you in a certain direction, you need the wrappings of the precepts in order to protect you from the wounds that can come from them. I think you guys remember, I know I've said it several times, I can't say it enough because it's such a harmful thing I did that I always try to remember things that I do, not in a judgment or blaming way, but in a realistic pointing that I can remember the suffering of harm that gets caused by simple things. So I was teaching at Sam's when we were at Soto, and I left Soto and I got on the light rail to go up to Capitol Hill. It's only like about, I don't know, 13, 14 minutes away. I pull out my cell phone. I'm looking at my little, you know, Facebook. I don't read it. I don't open the articles. I just read the headlines. Pretty, you know, just using it as a tool, just sitting there. And I read some headline that upset my soul so bad that I left my awareness and got sucked into some vortex of rage. It's probably the best phrase I could use. But it was anger and rage, and I was mad, and I'm spinning all in this world of cussing people out and talking about people, and I'm sitting here on the train completely disconnected from where I'm at. I'm in a world of rage. This is where I'm trying to point to. And because I was disconnected, I don't know what's building up in me. So get to Capitol Hill. I know where I'm at. It's not like I'm not present to what's going on. Get to Capitol Hill, stop happens. I get up to go off the train. Some woman is getting on the train. And I'm on Capitol Hill. I think people know I'm a Dhamma teacher. I think they see me in these different settings. And she had this humongous grin on me, on her. I don't know how she knew me or what she knew me, but she had good energy, goodwill, smiling at me, and just was like, hi. And all that rage that had been smoldering in me went straight into her. And I looked at her like, who the hell are you looking at? What are you smiling at? I'm not talking to you. Why are you even be talking to me? And I saw her face go from this bright, beaming smile to this wretched kind of, oh, I did the wrong thing. We're not talking today. Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry. So sorry. Oh, my God. And she was white. I'm black. I think she thought, okay, no talking to the black people. Don't smile. Oh, my God. It was so terrible. So terrible. But I didn't know that I had done that. This is what I'm trying to point to. I get off the train, go across the platform, and it wasn't until I got to the escalator going up that I realized what had just happened. And I turned around and the door was closed. I do not remember what that woman looks like. I bet she will never smile at me ever again. If she ever sees me, if I see somebody looking at me like with a scowlful look, I'll be like, are you the lady I snapped at? I'm so sorry. You can smile at me again. I'm okay. You can't pull that back. Do you see what kind of a festering wound here? So you could see how I could wrap this up into denial, and I could let scar tissue kind of, you know, I don't know if any of you've ever had scar tissue from a surgery. Oh my God, it can get painful. And it distorts the body's movement because it's painful, because the spot it's scarring over is still tender. So I could do that. I could have a lot of regret, kind of hide it and don't tell anyone. And then every time I sit, it would come up from time to time out of the blue, poking at me, reminding me, how could you be a Dhamma teacher and do that? But the thing is, when I think about talking about the precepts in relation to these technologies, I was in the vortex of that technology. I was sucked into the world that the social media outlet I was on was sucking me in. And then when you watch that movie and you see just how much they point us in a direction, that's what's a little scary. So the point is that I realized, looking back, a lot of the articles that I saw the headlines to back then were about the same kinds of behavior that upset me so. So I am constantly being drawn in. But because the article came from my friend, I'm thinking, oh, I'm friends with them. You know, I'm not just friends with random people, but it came from them. So there's this way in which I'm being pointed towards fueling this anger. And that anger hit this woman. I could have went up the escalators and never even known him, never even paid attention. I'm sure there's been plenty of times I have given somebody the evil eye and didn't even know, didn't ever even think about it, went straight on up the elevator and all about business. But that's here is what we're, this is what we're pointing to think about. So I'm going to give you a way to begin to think about these, Think about these screens, these electronics, these cell phones, these social media worlds we go into, and how it relates to the precepts. So the first precept here is, you know, we undertake the training to refrain from killing. You could say harming in this non-harming way, non-harming living beings. So one way to think about it is to pay attention to your judgment. I mean, for years I took a nonviolent communication, and nonviolent communication, people would always say, I'm not violent. I don't do any violence. And I'm not going to talk like that. But they wouldn't realize that their judgments were cutting off someone's life to be who they freely were. And instead, they had to live within the box that we had created for them in our judgment. And so that judgment became what Marshall Rosenberg was pointing to as a violent way of characterizing someone. So when we start thinking about our judgments, our angers, our fears, our self-centeredness, this way that we basically diminish other people in order to protect ourselves, that is in effect harming other people. And oftentimes, the way we are using the way social media is using us, it is pointing us towards a direction where we will not be able to see or have any degree of compassion for anyone who does not believe and think like we do. This is what I learned from the movie. It's pointing us so pinpointed that we think we have the facts. This is what Eugene Cash said that I don't know if I talked about it here, but Eugene Cash talked about this article, I think it was in the New York Times, that we have like several different realms of reality. We've never lived in a world like this. There's always been one basic set of facts, and anybody who didn't believe in those facts were kind of kooky. That's it. They're the kooky ones. Everybody knows what the facts is. That's it. But we live in a world where the media has basically pointed us towards an understanding of facts. But they've done the same pointing to all these different groups. So everyone is thinking that their beliefs are based on a set of facts. And everybody else is kind of kooky because they don't know the facts. We got to be careful within that realm because we'll start judging other people. And in our anger, fear, and self-centeredness, we can cause harm just because we're operating at a wrong view and we don't know. So taking what's not freely or what's not offered. And in this way, you could extend that out to when we steal and take what's not freely offered, we have a way of trying to control our environment, manipulate situations to our benefit, and put demands on other people around us. So there's a way in which we take what we learn in social media and push it upon everybody else. So we're taking their, I don't know, right to their opinions, right to their own understandings, and we are pushing it upon other people. That is taking their space up without them freely offering it to us. I think the sexual misconduct it has to do with, I noticed that there's a lot of, I think Michael Moore put this in his book, Angry White Men, I think. I can't remember where I saw it, but that there's all these movies have these opening scenes of gratuitous sexual violence against women. Like there's just sexual violence against women in all of these opening and all of these action movies to sort of generate some kind of interest. And so there's a way in which Hollywood uses violence against women or just violence in general as a kind of, it's gratuitous. It's just to keep us interested in wanting to do it. So it's paying attention to whether or not sexuality or violence is being, you're being sexually manipulated by some of the way social medias and electronic movies, things like that, are trying to get us hooked into it. Refraining from harsh and harmful speech is pretty self-explanatory. It's just paying attention to what kinds of things we're looking at and paying attention to what kinds of things that we're connected to. And the last one, of course, is intoxication. And I figured that's pretty self-explanatory. We definitely can get intoxicated by these things. And so paying attention to how much usage we're getting out of it and what we're doing with it. Ultimately, I'm not of the advocate. I don't advocate we need to stop looking at all these screens. I'm not of that, I guess, position. What I'm more connected to is that we pay attention to what it is that we're looking at. Look at whatever you want, but pay attention to what you're looking at. And just like I remind myself about this moment in time with this woman at the train station, to remember what's going on with it, that's what we have to stay connected to. What the people in the film ultimately said was that they are all addicted to their phones just like we are. So it's not like somehow they are above it and they know exactly what's going on. But I think as practitioners, we do have a way that we can wrap these gadgets around in the precepts as a way to help us begin to practice with it and I think heal us from the wounds that we get from it more than anything else. It's a skill that we're learning. That's what it is. And so I want to end with this poem. Because I think as practitioners, we should begin to think of ourselves as artists in the skill of practice. As householders, we're not masters of the Dhamma, but we are skilled in practice and we are cultivating a level of artistry and craft around how to practice with, how to be with, how to move in our lives as householders in a skillful way, through skillful means. And we are doing something here in the West for all of our problems. We are doing something very different. We are not just leaving the meditation to the monks. And we are not just practicing the precepts. Somehow we've turned this entire practice of Dhamma into these many little sanghas of meditation and getting together and talking about the Dhamma in deeper ways and just the way in which we articulate and be with the Dhamma and practice and meditate. We're doing something different. And if we're doing something different, then we need to hone into our craft that way. So I want to leave you with this second poem that I couldn't make up my mind with, called Putting in a Window by John Brantingham. And John says, carpentry has a rhythm that should never be violated. I think this is just like mindfulness or meditation practice. You need to move slowly methodically, never trying to finish early, never hoping that you'll be done sooner. It's best if you work without thought of the end. Sound familiar? If hurried, you end up with crooked door joints and drafty rooms. Do not work after you are annoyed, just so the job will be done more quickly. Stop when you began to curse at the wood. Putting in a window should be a joy. You should love the new header and the sound of your electric screwdriver as it secures the new beams. The only good carpenter is the one who knows that he's not good. He's afraid that he'll ruin the whole house and work slowly. It's the same as cooking or driving. The good cook shows humility and their souffle never fails because they are terrified that it will fall the whole time they're cooking. The good driver knows that they might plow into a mother walking her three-year-old and so watches for them carefully. The good carpenter knows that his beams might be weak and a misstep might ruin the place he loves. In the end, find your own pace and you lose time. And when you started, the sun was high. Now that you're finished, it's dark. Tomorrow, you might put in the door. The next day, you'll start on your deck. Thank you so much for your kind attention. Let's take a moment for some questions. I'm going to put the name of the movie in the chat here. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You should be able to unmute yourself. I'll double check though. Yeah. Oh, wait. No, you can't. Hold on. Now you can. Okay. There you go.
Okay. Hello, Tori. Thank you for this talk. I really appreciate you taking on this topic. It's very timely. I really like bringing together the precepts and the technology. And the one thing that I wanted to just share that I remember from I went on one retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh years ago with like 900 people, and I remember him going through the precepts, and one of the things that really stuck with me was talking about intoxicants, the precept about intoxicants. And he had this very broad definition of what an intoxicant is.
Yes.
And the way you're describing, you know, technology to me, it sounds very much like that. And in, at that time, you know, this was 2005, he was talking about movies, like the movies you open your consciousness to can be very powerful. You know, they can have a very powerful effect on you, like you were saying about sexual violence with women. And, you know, like if you keep watching things like that, it shapes your consciousness. And the example you gave in the light rail with Facebook, you know, reminded me of that too. So it's almost like, you know, you have to treat this as this, you know, something really strong that has to be used with a lot of, you know, a lot of care. And some people may be able to barely tolerate it at all, you know, and others may be able to use it moderately without, you know, it taking over their lives. But it's highly addictive, you know. So anyway, I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, I think Hans' definition is quite broad for all the precepts, but especially that with intoxicants. And you're right, that was the reason why the movie was suggested for me, because I would not say that the screens were addictive. I was saying that they, I think I was operating under the notion that they were tools that we use, and that, yeah, some people might get addicted to it because you use it too much, but just put it down, right? But the yogi wanted me to see that the people who were making these tools were saying, no, they are basically like cigarettes.
Yeah.
It was addicted from the moment you started smoking. That was, it was pretty much self-assured that you were going to continue with the process. And so I can remember having fights with my sister because she refused to get a flip phone. At that point, she was not going to get a flip phone. I can't even believe we argued about that and how much I, you know, diminished her because she wouldn't step into the new age. She wouldn't step into the real world. And oh my God, I treated her so bad. But that this is what happens, because you're not necessarily appreciating what it is that it was doing. And the movie really helped me see. I'm scared to look at my phone now. Every time something happens, I'm like, I don't want to look at it. Don't pick it up to her. Don't even look at it. It's so scary. I kind of knew it. You know, you could kind of see, because if you search for something, then all of a sudden all these ads show up all over the place, wherever you go, whatever you use, it doesn't matter. Everything is all linked in together, so it's like it follows you. So there was a little bit of that, but I didn't quite realize how much it is designed to entice you. That's what I think I didn't really recognize.
Yeah.
Yeah, so thanks.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, David. I see you, Ron. I'll get you next.
Hey, Tori. I just had, I think this might be related to what Peter was just saying, but I was thinking about my usage of technology, and I have less of an issue with like social media, but more like just researching things. Like I'll get like whatever question, like I have a lot of questions, and then I'll be like, oh, what is that? And then there's things like, I don't even remember a lot of stuff anymore because like I don't have to, because I just look it up again. So it's kind of curious, like, would that fit in the intoxication type of, like layering it over like the modified precepts, or do you think there'd be some other place where that would fit?
Well, I think this is about you knowing your own usage, right? So, you know, because let's take it like this. We are apprehensive about smoking. We are apprehensive about drugs, these opiates. We're apprehensive about alcohol because we know they are addicting. So because we know they are addicting, we use them with a little bit more care, right? Or if you don't use them with care and you get addicted to it, then you're in recovery and you are still treating it with this degree of care. The problem with social media is, this is the part I didn't understand. So what you think you're just searching, but what these people were saying is it's that they, the algorithms they use is forcing you into a certain search parameters. So that means that it prompts you to always want to go search. It's enticing you to want to look further and learn more and understand this and understand that. It's not just, oh, I type something in, I get my question answers. It kind of knows you better than you know you. So if you're just searching randomly and it's, and you believe that you're not being sucked into it, then yeah, it's fine. You just, but the way you want to begin to test that is to consider, are you intoxicated with it? And if you are intoxicated with it, how would you know that? Other than trying to say, okay, I'm not going to search for anything. I'm going to go with an unanswered question and see what happens. This is what I think the movie is pointing to, is that if you think of it as a tool, then the idea that you're just using it to search something is not that big of a deal. But what the movie's pointing to is that thing that you think is a tool, like a bicycle is or a hammer, is not a tool. It is designed to look for your weaknesses, look for your habits, look for your wants, and it calculates who you are and what you are and then sends it that way. And that's what we have to be careful for. So even if you pick up your phone to or look at the computer and do a little searching, the fact that you're on that computer, it is also grabbing a hold of you. And it will begin to entice you in other ways. So it knows about you. And it just, it's just the way that it maneuvers.
Gotcha.
That's more of what it is. Yeah. So I see your hand. I'm going to get Ron and then I'll get your hand. Go ahead, Ron. Ron, I can't hear you. I see you're not muted, but you may have to get closer to the computer so I can hear you. Yeah, I know you're talking, but I can't hear you very much.
Can you hear me now?
I think what I'm going to do, Ron, is see if Darah or Ken, if one of you guys can chat Ron and see what's happening with his sound. I'm going to take Sean and then come right back to you, Ron. Go ahead, Sean.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
There were two things I noticed. I'm not on social media very much. However, I am. I look at my phone for my actual email.
Oh, yeah. They talk
and
about email
just
too.
As, it's just as... grabbing, if you will, for your email. And what I notice is that I have that when I get an actual email, my, you know, phone will buzz. But I will check my phone even when it's not buzzing. Like, it will tell me when I have an email. So why won't I just wait for the buzz? I don't wait for the buzz. I'm looking at my phone to see if it's going to buzz or if it's there and I didn't hear it or something like that. But it's like, and it's like when you always do that, constantly looking at your phone, looking at your phone, looking at your phone, it is grabbing you away from what you're doing. It's just basically pulling you in. It's pulling you in. And that's just an email.
Yep.
I'm like, this is just crazy. I have to, so I flipped it off. So, and I, when I did that the first day that I actually turned it off, I felt my whole body relax. I wasn't constantly looking at the phone. I wasn't constantly thinking, will I get an email or whatever? Do I have one? It just, and so it's actually been a few months now where I don't even have it on. And sometimes I forget to check my phone. I'm like, wow. And it's been actually pretty nice that I don't actually do that as much. I don't feel that draw. It isn't a draw. I don't feel that pull. I feel like I'm literally being pulled to look at my phone.
You are being pulled.
Yeah, yeah. And then it also made me think about when I'm on my phone or I'm doing something else with it, that's my attention. They're taking my attention. And my attention is precious.
Yes.
And so it's just, yeah, it really just kind of, it's like, to actually think about that's what they are buying. They're buying my attention. And the actual cost of it, I don't, for me, that actual cost is too high. No.
What is happening? I don't know what's going to happen to us in this world that we're living in with this. They didn't know either. I mean, they are the ones that created it, and they didn't know what was going to happen. It is a strange place that we're living in here. And it's come, you know, in some respects, watching that movie is probably the first time I had compassion for a lot of those people at that, White House. I remember having compassion for the people at the White House. On January 6th, I haven't had a lot of compassion for a lot of those people. I pretty much lumped them all together and was pretty much mad at everybody. But after watching that movie, I really woke up to this idea that people can be, that they really could be pigeonholed into an understanding without even knowing that you're a pigeonholed into that understanding. So this is, but for our purposes, we have to see that we are also being pigeonholed. It's not like we got the wisdom and they're the ones being pigeonholed. If they could just come on over to our side, then they will not be pigeonholed because we're not pigeonholed. So that's what I got to understand in this. We all are. And because it's a computer algorithm that's giving us the information, it's sending us down the rabbit hole on our own. So I think what you're saying, Sean, pointing out that you let go of it, that's the beauty. That's the gift of it. You can do that. I told you my friend, I think I told you guys my friend, Dawn Scott, she doesn't have any color on her phone. It's the light goes out and it's so weird. It doesn't even look like a phone. You know, I was looking at it like, what kind of phone is this? She's like, I've turned all the things off. She turned all the gadgets and whistles and stuff on it. So it doesn't really entice her like that. But, you know, even with that, she's still enticed by it the same way you are with email because it's designed to do that. That's what we have to really begin to understand. So Ron, let's see, if I can't hear you, can you chat your question? I can't hear you, so can you type it? You are doing so much talking, I can't hear you. Are you saying don't worry about it? Okay, it's crazy. Well, I'll let it go then. And I only have 1 minute before I'm going to let Deb have plenty of time so I don't make the announcement. People have to share all the announcements in 2 minutes. And then, of course, you guys get to leave on the right time. So this is a natural place to stop. So next week we'll talk about, we'll have a little chat about it. We'll break up into some small groups and kind of talk a little bit about it. And we'll see if I can't, I'm going to get the Thich Nhat Hanh's precepts so that you can hear them, different versions of the precepts. And we'll talk a little bit about how this would show up with these precepts. All right? A little bit more. All right, good. And we'll do a summary of what we talked about, but you know I got to throw something new in there. Otherwise, why come twice? Okay.